Do you want to understand where the advertising and marketing industry is headed over the next 12 months? Then tune into our new webcast series, Reframing the Industry. We'll be joined by three special guests debating a new ecosystem map that ExchangeWire has created to help you understand what the future business model for agencies and service partners, brands and marketers, and technology suppliers looks like. Part one is happening at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, June 29, and you can register at ExchangeWire.com/IR webcast. Make sure you're part of the conversation.
To be joined by a special guest today,
the MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon to whenever anyone's listening to this. Me and Matt.
Pleasure to have you on board, Simon. And joining me for what is probably my last recording of the MadTech podcast, given that I gave her Poland in the Euro sweepstakes as her top draw team, it's Lindsay Roundtree, Head of Content at ExchangeWire.
Listen, the arguments that we've had in the office about me drawing Poland, well, the arguments I've had with all of you about me drawing Poland have been something to behold, frankly. I'm not happy. I think I'm the only team in the top tier that didn't actually, that came bottom of their group. They were horrendous.
Yeah, but you've balanced out with Netherlands, who are, I think, right at the top at the moment. So swings and roundabouts.
That's very true, yes.
Diving into our first news story of the week, Amazon has started to block Google from testing Flock on some of its websites. The e-commerce giant has updated the source code behind their flagship Amazon.com site, as well as their Whole Foods, Woot, Zappos, the ShopBop and Goodreads properties to prevent Flock from gathering any information from these domains. Part of Google's post-cookie privacy sandbox, Flock lets marketers target audiences by using algorithms and online activity to group users into cohorts based on their shared interests and characteristics. While Google stresses that this information is anonymized and cannot be linked to specific individuals, critics accuse Flock of being as invasive as third-party cookies and of opening the door to unethical targeting and discrimination. Others have complained that Flock will only solidify Google's dominance within digital advertising once cookies disappear. Indeed, Matthew Swanson, who is an analyst at RBC Capital Markets, said that the move could be an attempt by Amazon to protect their own valuable first-party data and may also indicate the firm is looking to take their role as DSP more seriously, potentially creating a competitive advantage over Google. Interested to get your first thoughts on this and also as to why Amazon has done this, and do you agree with Swanson that it's a purely competitive move? Simon, let's start off with you.
So, an apology if there's any weird background noise. I have a puppy at home who is in the room with me. So, I don't hope you can't hear him. He's in a crate, but if you do, I apologise to anyone listening.
Look, well, now I want to see the puppy, of course.
Well, I'll show the puppy at the end.
Okay, thank you. That's all I care about now. The rest of it is irrelevant to me.
I think it's a super interesting move on Amazon's part. There are probably three points I draw out. One, absolutely shows the value of publisher data. Publishers, first-party data has always been valuable and potentially increases in value as we move forward into the changing identity landscape we live in. So publishers in general, not speaking to Amazon's choices, are absolutely right to consider how and where they make their data accessible, and whether participating in Flock or participating in any of those schemes and initiatives are the right things for them to do as a business. I think it's also really early. Even the Flock trials are pretty early doors. When we think about EMEA as a region, you know, those trials haven't even come to region. So for just working out where that line sits on the privacy piece with it. I think it's an interesting move. I'm sure it's representing that Amazon have a great wealth of first party data, particularly across those stores, and particularly they actually have quite a breadth of data points. So I'm sure they've always also been a very predominantly first party led solution. They're buying on Amazon is their own, right? That where the ad stack is their own. It's not an open market that everyone buys into. So it feels more just an extension of their current strategy. I'm not saying it's particularly meaningful beyond that. There are thousands of websites that will participate in these schemes as well. But the thing I take out of it most is it shows the value of good data from a publisher and how important that's going to be in the ecosystem going forward. And we as a publisher agree with that. And the publishers we partner with, we agree with that. So, you know, I think publisher-derived audiences are very much a part of the future.
Absolutely. Lindsay, do you think that other publishers will therefore follow suit and block Flock from their sites?
I do. I'm not surprised that Amazon have done this. If I were Amazon, would I want Google Flock accessing my first party data, the signals from my first party data. No, I wouldn't. And I think a lot of premium publishers will feel the same way, particularly when the publishers that that we've certainly spoken to have said that they don't really want to have Google controlling this. It shouldn't be owned by anybody. If it's being owned by anybody, it should be owned by the publishers themselves, not by an entity like Google. And actually, ultimately, it should be something that's probably decentralized completely. But however, like from the perspective of publishers, the concern here will be from people on the outside looking in, going, well, Amazon can ensure that their data isn't being captured by Flock to allow buyers to use Amazon signals when they're buying media. But Amazon will probably most definitely use Flock themselves when it comes to actually data signals and buying media. So the interesting thing will be if these premium publishers and Amazon, as an example, are going to take but not going to give back. Now, that's something that, you know, should you be concerned about that? Is that something that you should be worried about? Probably not, because that's kind of very much how many things in this industry work anyway, to a certain degree. But again, it plays to kind of the tango that Amazon and Google, actually the rest of GAFA, kind of are doing on a daily basis anyway. You know, they will give and take and not really want the other to see what they're doing. But the mid, you know, as Simon said, there will be thousands of other websites that will participate in Flock and allow the data to be available. And those mid to long tail publishers, from a buyer perspective, probably give you more insight in terms of what I'll get more insight from a niche kind of long tail publisher that's kind of like a specialist publisher about what that person's doing than I might do from, say, Guardian News and Media, where I'm reading generic news and there's no real inference as to kind of who I am or what I enjoy or what I like. So I wonder if actually the mid to long tail in this could be more interesting from a Flock perspective too. But it will mean that you will not be able to, I don't believe you'll be able to access kind of any premium data when you're buying Flock. So you need to keep that in mind. It's going to be, you could consider Flock to be in that case of slightly lower quality if you're using it for data signals to actually buy media. But I mean, as far as I understand it, it's very, very easy to block Flock from your site because it's at the browser level, right? So in your header, I think it's just you have to just have to put permissions policy interest cohort equals open close brackets, basically nothing, and then that's it. You're blocking Flock, or you're blocking from at the browser level. That's basically it. So I do think a lot of publishers will do the same, but I don't premium publishers certainly. But I don't see the mid to long tail doing that because, as Simon said, I agree with that. They're going to participate, because they'll probably get enough in return as well.
I think there's also, I think, and I'm not 100% about this, like, I'm just making a point, it shows how incredibly complex the industry is becoming to operate in. And that's another actual challenge for the whole industry, for publishers specifically as well, about the level of effort and engagement and resourcing required to do some of these things. My understanding, I think, is if you also don't participate in Flock, you almost can't read it. Does that make sense? But I don't know how that applies to when it's on a third-party site. I know you can't read it on the site where you're not participating. The only other thing I'd say is Flock cohorts are expected to be cohorts that change very frequently. And my understanding, again, not saying it's accurate, you can only be in one cohort at a time. So the interesting thing is about when you think about the breadth, actually Amazon have such a breadth of data, actually, what cohort would you put someone in? Because like e-commerce is too wide. And then such a level of transactability through all the different things that people buy. Actually, in some ways, it may not be great data, to your point, Lindsay, because actually you'd be in every cohort imaginable because, you know, speaking about myself, I buy everything from clothes to food to puppy toys to running shoes, right? So how does that define me into the right cohort that's addressable? And again, remember, cohorts also aren't identifiable by the behavior. There is an expectation that then the ad tech will do some of that regrouping to identify what a Flock cohort actually is. It just means it's a cohort of like-minded interests. It's so complex, it makes my head hurt. I used to think I was smart. I'm definitely not.
Well, I didn't, and I'm very, very confused. I wasn't actually that aware. I didn't really think, I just didn't really think about the fact that you're only going to be in one cohort at a time. It makes sense, but at the same time, it doesn't, because does that not make it a bit limiting?
My
brain's getting scrambled by this.
Again, I think you potentially could be in many cohorts at a time, but you're only assigned to one cohort at a time. Right. So it's what's the prevalent interest at the time on your recent behavior? Or I don't know. That's all going to be machine. I don't know that we know. And that's the danger. We don't know that we know. That's the concern for a publisher. browser adoption is part of this. A lot of the other browsers have indicated they themselves are not yet willing to, or not yet trialing Flock. They haven't said they're not willing to work with Flock. I think Mozilla have put out some concerns around Flock and privacy, but I don't think any of those are shut. So the real problem in this is it's significant, but it's part of that evolving landscape around privacy, and it's going to continue to evolve over the next 18 months, 2 years.
And absolutely. The point I was sort of thinking there in terms of that kind of granularity in Flock, I don't think Amazon themselves have kind of fully understood that either, because they're trying basically a different blocking method on Whole Foods compared to their other properties. So they're obviously going, right, how can we capture as much of this data as possible without obviously engaging fully with Flock? So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out going forward.
Mm, I didn't realise that.
And also remember the different priorities within a business. So speaking as a business that's a full stack provider, a publisher business, the same is true of Google, different elements will want different things at different points. And so that decision could be made from a webmaster point of view versus the ad platform business in Amazon, right? It could be, the best example of this is obviously the whole Chrome privacy sandbox, where there is the separation between Chrome. It's difficult because we always talk about Google, right? We should talk about Chrome and privacy sandbox, and then Google Ads as something different. Google Ads are going to be expected to play via the sandbox to some degree, to the same set of rules, whether or not there is any difference. There's the CMA piece. I think you covered that the other week as well, around that. So sometimes the decisions are not necessarily made for the reasons we in ad tech or marketing would think. They may actually be made for other reasons from the core of the business or where people are developing their other business lines too.
Moving on to our second news story of the week. Apple will crack down on fingerprinting by releasing a new feature that will prevent advertisers from accessing customers' IP addresses. The private relay tool will render IP tracking obsolete by redirecting traffic through two separate servers, disguising internet users' IP addresses so that they cannot be used for targeting. Announcing the new feature at their Worldwide Developers Conference earlier this month, Apple also revealed plans to obscure IP addresses on the Safari browser and Mail app. Mail and Safari will also be kitted out with privacy reports, which will alert users to the trackers that are being prevented from profiling them. Even more startling for advertisers is Apple's plans for a feature called Hide My Mail, which will allow users to create random email addresses that forward to, while masquerading as, their personal inbox. With Apple's intention to make this default across Mail, Safari, and iCloud, the solution will have serious implications on Unified ID 2.0, as well as any email-based identity solutions. Again, keen to get your first impressions on this one, as well as how devastating could private relay be to advertisers that use fingerprinting. Lindsay, let's start off with you.
I think that, well, the fingerprinting crackdown has been going on ever since Apple launched ITP, Intelligent Tracking Prevention, a few years ago, because the first thing that the ad tech did was go, okay, I can't now track you properly via IDFA anymore or via a cookie, so I'm going to try and fingerprint you instead. And that's worked well for them. So Apple have been trying to find ways to block fingerprinting for a long time and have done various different things because people were using different parameters and domains, for example, to be able to work out where people have come from, what they were doing. So this is the next step in evolution, in my opinion, of Apple trying to crack down all these different things just to try to stop people trying to find nefarious ways of taking other people's data. The interesting thing for me is I had to look at a video to work out exactly how private relay works and as I understand it. So you have one server that deals with, if I am searching a website, one server will take me to the website. Won't take me there. It'll start the process for me. Then it'll get blocked by this relay in the middle, and then another server will take care of me actually landing on the website. But the other server will have no idea who I am, where I've come from. It'll be a completely different IP, so they can't recognize me or track me in any way. It's not a VPN, so I couldn't, for example, go and decide to choose my own location and decide to actually, if I wanted to go and watch like Hulu, for example, choose my location as being the US. But as a consumer, as a user, I can choose for my location to either be in the region of where I am. So I could choose my location, I imagine, to be in London, or I could choose my location to be like broader, like the UK. So it's not completely, so it's there's nothing else I can do, but it means that nobody else can see who I am. So I think from a privacy perspective, there'll be a lot of privacy advocates that will be really applauding this and saying this is a really, really good way of approaching privacy, because not even Apple can see the IP address or see where you've originally come from. So it's not like they're getting their own data. But the point to recognize, remember here, is that Apple don't need to see that data because Apple have so much data about you already. So Apple can go along this route and do this and really show that they're a massive privacy advocate because they already have everything they need to know about you in the first place through all the information that they already have from you as a device user. And there's so much first party data and so many other behavioral signals they can still get from you in terms of how your phone's used, whatever else, how your devices are used. They don't need to actually look at your browser history probably because it's not what the area of focus is. So they can really show that they're privacy advocates and look like they're owning this narrative while not actually necessarily doing so in kind of the background. But I think it's really interesting. I think it will force, I wonder, because it will, the challenge will be that the loss of first party data people might have through things like the lack of fingerprinting, through the hide my mail, all this kind of stuff. Apple told its publishers to try to build a first party relationship with their consumers. And now Apple is saying, actually, we're not even going to let you do that anymore. Because despite the fact we told you to do that, we're now saying that actually we think that you're still abusing your relationship with them, and we'd rather have the relationship than we'd rather you have it. So we're going to take that away from you as well. But there's a lot of opportunity for consumer abuse, I would say, kind of with the subscriptions and everything else, but very little opportunity for ad tech abuse. So they've kind of fixed one thing, but not fixed the other. It's all a minefield, but I feel like Apple, when it comes to anything privacy related, Apple normally start the process, and then the likes of Google normally have to follow suit in some way. So what I'll be interested in is what Google will do next at a browser level. So that's very rambling, but hopefully that all made sense.
It absolutely did. Look, there are a few things in here I think are important, and it actually comes from the first topic. One is there is an arc to this discussion around privacy and advertising and targeting. As with the first one, but particularly this one, consent is critical for anything we do. But also increasingly, anything that is one-to-one is increasingly going to be challenged over the medium term, right? Just by browser intervention. And so there is a piece of potentially needed industry transformation about how we build audiences, how we target audiences, and how we record success. And that may be coming back to more things like panel-based measurement versus individual measurement. That may be, again, some of the almost cohort or next-gen contextual type solutions where you're building an audience, but the audience is very anonymized, is not related to any logged-in data. It's the machine learning you've generated of what this behavior potentially buckets somebody as. There is this, without doubt, Lindsay, you're right, there will be Apple announcing this, which is for 16, right, which is actually comes out next year. Google will respond at some point in their next Worldwide Developer Conference, which I think is September for them from memory often. I think that's roughly the time frame. We're going to see this evolution, and regulators are looking at it from two ways. There are definitely regulators looking for the impact of competition, and you'll have seen that in some of the CMA discussion around measures with Google. But also there are privacy regulators looking at is too much data being shared. So the arc is going one way and one way only. And we as an industry actually do really have to embrace that. This one specifically is super interesting because there are some cases where IP usage is really important, not for advertising or targeting. And I don't know whether there are cases where, because these are early proposals, there's still feedback to come as well. I think, there's still industry engagement. Exactly where they net out might be interesting to see there. I think also you may see that they're able to replace, rather than give you the IP address, right, within the bid stream, where that was then potentially open abuse, they may just pass you the location, which enables you to do some of that targeting without all of the targeting, without the access to the original data point. So that was an even longer and more rambling answer.
just because you have it, does it mean you should use it? So actually, for many people, that broad location data is probably all they're going to need in the first place. Everything else they are able to get in the bid stream from an IP address probably, you know, should not be actually used in the first place, and will encourage advertisers to have to go down a different route and find different ways of targeting their user in the first place in a more privacy conscious way.
Yeah, and I think the email point is interesting as well, right? Like, because actually there's been a version of that feature for a while. When you go and log in on your phone, it can suggest a different email for you. It's been working in a while. It's interesting what publishers respond to that. They may require your true email address in order to give you access, right? There may be publisher reactions to, no, in order to operate my business, I require some level of identification from you. But that is also going to come back to explaining the value exchange, right? And that still, as an industry, as publishers, something we need to continue to do and do better. I actually think a lot of the time, I spend a lot of time talking about addressable emails and what that will recapture in the audience, but that's likely to only be 20%, 25% of the industry. I think it's really important we focus as much and more energy in how do we move beyond that one-to-one targeting approach. And there is a transition phase, and all these solutions have real value. You know, we have a global solution with Connect ID. Our own DSP and advertiser data to publisher data. It's not a broad solution. It's a one-to-one solution. It gathers consent in a privacy-compliant way. It is consented for the use of that email address. But even those solutions, we have to think about what's the long-term arc on them, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And actually, the version that you spoke of there, Simon, it's been around a while, where you can, when you're logging into a new account for the first time, you can either use your own email address or ask it to Apple to create a fake one that will then forward your email address. I've had a couple of instances, to your point, where the company has said, for you to be able to use these features, and they have been legitimate kind of account level features that actually they do require my email address. They've had to explain to me why, if you use the Apple's version, we can't then give you the access you need. For example, like linking something to Alexa, for example, like that, a smart speaker. So they do have to explain to you clearly why you need to use given your email address. And even then you're sort of thinking, yeah, but is that true? Is that really, really true? So it will require some explanation and some education for users to understand, as you say, the value exchange of that.
But also there is the fear of reliance on your, and this is not about Apple, reliance on your phone to tell you what your login email is here, right? Like, phones break, things reset, accounts get hacked, iCloud accounts get hacked, any of those things, all of those things are possible. And so I actually don't know what the consumer reaction is going to be, interestingly, to not using their own email address where they are logging in or giving identity. Like, this feels like a feature built with privacy advocates in mind. Rather than necessarily, I always like to think, what would my mum do? And she loves ad tech. She's a big fan. What I do at all.
Don't you think you work for Google?
Nearly. my son of my family, and he's only 10, has given me the best and most accurate description of what I do out of anyone. So he listens. That's good to know. But I don't think my mum is going to sign. It's interesting. I'll use my mum and my stepdad, right? Just a little bit of real world. My stepdad, very computer savvy, computer scientist originally. I can see him really embracing that feature. And I can see my mum looking at it going, no, I don't want to keep creating thousands of fake email addresses and then have to rely on someone else to tell me to remind me. She has enough problem remembering my name. Imagine trying to remember, or being reliant on the system remembering that email address to us. So I think it'll be interesting how some of this stuff actually also plays out with consumers over the medium term.
I think you're right. I think that they rely on you having to actually be part of their entire ecosystem and not just have one device in that. And I use the example of where, if I'm trying to create a new account on my phone, either mobile web or app-based, and Apple will suggest a password for me. Now, I'm never going to do that because actually I don't use Safari. I use Safari on my phone, but I don't use Safari on my laptop, despite the fact that it is actually a MacBook. So I'd never be able to remember that password or not have a clue where it's kept to be able to use it. So I'm logging into the browser, I'll never be able to find that password again because obviously it's nonsense. Since gobbledygook, not my password system that I have in place. And I feel the same way about the email. So if you're a person that looks at the password they suggest and goes, no, that's far too complicated, I'll do what I know and I'm used to, I think you'll probably feel the same about the email address as well.
Quite possibly. And I think where, sort of to your points earlier, where marketers, publishers, they may not go, hang on a minute, we might just start having to block iCloud email addresses because half of them are not legitimate emails. And then I think if that were to take place, then obviously, you know, consumers go, actually, if I'm putting in this email address, it's just going to get blocked anyway, and I'm going to have to put in my real one anyway. So it'll be interesting to see how the use case scenario works out.
I agree.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, I mean, I think some of these solutions are quite eloquent, but they're also really complex, right? They're really complex for if they're complex for us who work in this industry, and they are complex for us who work in this industry, they're really complicated for people who don't work in this industry or in the technology industry. And I think that'll be interesting to see where the risk there is that adoption is just, yeah, I'll just click it because it's part of OS, right? And that moves on to a much broader topic about macro controls, about decisions OSs make, and how that interplays with governments. And that's a topic we're not getting into and I'm not trying to get into. But you've seen the G7, right? There's the view of digital tax, globalization. Increasingly, there is regulatory activity, both on the privacy and competition side. So I think digital is still a relatively young industry, although it's 25, 30 years old, right? 25 years old, really. And programmatic in itself is, what, 10, 15 years old within that? Those are both young industries. There is a lot of evolution to come. There was a really, this is slightly off topic, but there was a really good tweet from Steven Sinofsky, who used to work at Microsoft when I was there a long time ago, and he used to be the head of Windows. And he talked about how change occurs and generational shifts occurs. And this was a little bit about future of work. But he actually talked about a lot of the success in America post the war was built on regimentation from war planning and success. And it was the war that changed how business went from being lots of local businesses to big corporations. And he's talking about we're only now really experiencing the expiration of phones into hands, of computers into hands, where digital is core to life. And that's right at the center of it, right? Like now, I know we nearly talked about a digital identity proposal from the EU, right? Where, and again, you ask the question, who do I want to control my digital identity? But increasingly, where do I sit in a metaverse or a multiverse where digital is as much part of my real life as my actual life?
It leads us nicely into the third story in terms of digital and globalization. Amazon is expected to dethrone Tesco to become the UK's largest retailer by 2025. A research from Edge Retail Insight projects gross sales by the US e-commerce giant to reach £77 billion within the next 4 years, overtaking Tesco, which is expected to rake in £76.1 billion. If this was to happen, this would more than double the firm's 2020 sales of £36.3 billion. The research also predicts that a rise in grocery sales will send Amazon's compound annual growth rate up 16.3% by 2025, far outpacing the 3.5% expected for Tesco, in the process making Amazon the 15th biggest seller of consumable products. The research reflects consumers' increased preference for and reliance on e-commerce. Online shopping is expected to account for a third of all UK retail chain sales over the next 4 years, up from 26% in 2020, and e-commerce will help boost the UK retail market to £500 billion by 2025 through more than 57.4% of added sales. Lots of percentages there. First question to you guys is, are you surprised by these predictions? And what does this sort of suggest about retail in the UK? Simon, let's start with you.
Not surprised. Not surprised. I mean, think about each of our own lives. Today is a real example. I have just taken a delivery from a UK retailer that has a physical and an online presence. I've taken a delivery from Amazon. I'm physically going to Tesco's later because I actually still quite like walking around shops, right? And it gets me out of my house and away from the screen. But if you think about, I guess I get 7 packages a day or 5 packages a day, it doesn't matter what the number is, through this pandemic change, whereas that used to be maybe one. The restrictions on work from home have massively accelerated some of that transformation to e-commerce that was already growing. And there was a stat about it growing 7 years. It sort of accelerated 7 years in 6 months in terms of where people are in that digital adoption and that life. And, you know, I often in the past, if I wanted something, I'd think about it at night and I'd write it down and then I'd go and look on my computer and maybe buy it online and collect it later. Well, now with the phone, I just order it while I'm there. So that trend doesn't surprise me. The challenge of the retail high street is 20 years old and is continuing to be a challenge. And I think a bit like we talked about reimagining targeting for digital advertising, we are going to see a reimagining of how towns operate, how retail operates. The one thing is, I don't think anyone wants to buy everything from the same spot. People want options. There is always a growth in options. So I think Amazon's growth will potentially cap out. I think there is room for growth for other retailers as well.
Absolutely. I think the one thing that did surprise me from the predictions is that online shopping is expected to only grow by 7% from 2020 to 2025, according to those stats. And I think the momentum that the COVID pandemic has brought, I think that will continue for the next 5 years. As you said, Simon, I think people will have that e-commerce element in their daily lives. And I think there's much more than 7% growth there. Lindsay, interested to get your thoughts on that and also what you think has fueled Amazon's growth specifically.
Yeah, I think I'm surprised by 7%. I would have thought it would be larger, but then maybe there's probably been such growth in the past 5 years, they'll have to kind of level out at some point, and maybe we have reached some kind of critical mass to a degree that the level of growth, the compounding annual growth rate, will still always go up, but will be a lower proportion. But I think that the pandemic has done so much for both online and physical retail in particular. Like, you know, we've talked in the podcast a lot during the pandemic about this, the 15 minute communities that have existed and been sprung up during the pandemic, where people haven't been able to go to work and leave their vicinity. So they've had to use their local shops, and they've had to combine the usage of local shops with the usage of a lot more e-commerce. So people are buying a lot more from Amazon while also going to their local shop to pick up stuff and going to local and supporting their local businesses as much as possible. I like to think that an element of that will remain post-pandemic, where there's more flexibility working from home and everything else. I like to think that will help some kind of revigoration in some form, some regeneration of what the high street looks like and what a town looks like. But as Simon said, there needs to be a reimagining of a town, and I think there has been so much talk about that, so much work on that in the past couple of decades, but there's still so much more to do. And what has the past 12 months taught us about how towns can or should operate? How can you make the most out of the community that exists within them? And that, for me, I find interesting and will help. I think that there is going to be a struggle for kind of big towns and cities, but I think the smaller towns will see a boost. The smaller towns that have been taken over by charity shops, where I'm from, my hometown in Hampshire, is one of those victims. I like to think that now, during the pandemic, that's seen a marked change, a marked improvement. People are actually wanting to go out and use their high street more, whereas for the past 10 years, just hasn't been the case. And every shop that's tried to open has had to close a few months later because just no one is on the high street shopping. So I like to think there'll be a difference there. And, you know, more pop-ups. We talked about pop-ups and more retail spaces. There's companies like Appear Here that allow you to do that. They help you rent spaces kind of on a short-term basis to be able to go and try new things. There's also a lot more where I live in Northeast London. There's a lot of co-working spaces there to encourage people that live and work in the local area to come out and use those as community hubs almost and share and everything else. And that, for me, is fascinating. From the e-commerce perspective, I think Amazon will continue to be very, very dominant. What I thought was funny was in terms of the largest kind of edible seller, and edibles, I don't mean cannabis treats, but they're going to overtake Shell, McColl's, BP and Wilko to become the 15th largest retailer of edible products. And I was just like, oh, but, you know, I think of Amazon as being so big generally. I think of them also being absolutely humongous when it comes to edible produce as well. And actually, Shell and BP, petrol stations, they are overtaking petrol stations who clearly must sell more food than I expected them to. And Wilko's is not known for its food. It does sell food, but it isn't known for selling food. So Amazon still actually have quite a long way to go if that's the level they're at in terms of food. But I certainly, during the pandemic, when I couldn't get a food delivery order from Sainsbury's or Tesco or Ocado because they were obviously prioritizing more vulnerable customers and only had limited slots available, the only place I could get an online delivery was Amazon Fresh. I tried it out for the first time and it was terrible, frankly, in terms of flexibility, in terms of options. It wasn't good. But in the past 12 months, they changed massively how they operate. It's much more easy to use. They've obviously got the Whole Foods connection. They have connection with Morrison's as well. and other kind of well-known brands too. So they are able to, they will comfortably be able to compete with those larger e-commerce, grocery delivery services in the UK. And they've got the money to back them to kind of allow them to scale quickly. And they've got the money to be able to go and buy companies like Whole Foods, or to be able to go and just partner with Morrisons to allow them to have even more access to even more produce, which will make them become synonymous with buying everything from one place.
There's a load of interesting trends in that though as well, right? Like one, convenience. The reason that petrol stations and McCall's sell so much food is convenience. I'm not there to buy food. I'm there to do something else, or I'm walking past and I buy it. Or, you know what? I'm having a terrible day. I ran out of coffee, so I've had to make a pot of coffee. I'm nearly running out of milk when we finish this. I'm going to walk up to McCall's, plug for McCall's, buy a pint of milk, right? Normally I buy my milk at Tesco's, but I don't have time to get in the car. That's how retail has always worked for some small localised. Don't forget that Amazon are also looking at going back into retail, into physical retail, into having presences, and what retail is may change to be much more experiential. Same with things like 5G, actually seeing more virtual experiential shopping opportunities that mean e-commerce moves out of being from a platform e-commerce perspective to a publisher or a brand or a self-brand. And then you see the rise in direct-to-consumer brands. Well, they're not all Amazon. They're not going through the Amazon path, right? They're using other means of distribution. I think we're dealing with digital transformation here to lives, and this is one factor of it. And I do, you know, I do also think Tesco wasn't the dominant supermarket when I was first a kid, right? Or other supermarket brands have been and gone. That is retail. Retail brands survive, succeed, come and go, often because they blow themselves up, or often because they do something stupid, or often because something a better, cheaper, more effective alternative arises. Think Lidl and Aldi just in the grocery sector, right? They have come in, because they've actually been around for a lot longer, but they exploded in the last five, seven years to take significant share and challenge the status quo. That is actually markets operating pretty well when you get challenges to the status quo. Yeah, I think I think people's convenience is actually one of the biggest drivers in everything we do. People want things to be easy, and that's why good, effective retail experiences, e-commerce experiences are going to be critical. Amazon does a great job in that space. You know, let's not forget the success of what it was Prime Day yesterday. We all love Prime Day. I didn't buy anything. I pride myself on not buying anything on Prime Day because I feel that I'm being oversold to. But there are great bargains out there. But Prime changed that concept of distribution, right? The biggest single shift, and the reason I buy stuff from Amazon because I know it's not necessarily cheaper, but I know I will get it within 15 hours, right, or 72 hours. The one gap I think that the other retailers need to close on is getting their point of delivery, their after-sales service, to be as effective, to be as consistent and efficient and reliable. And most of them are so much further than they were, but again, some of them didn't even have that presence or that opportunity pre-pandemic, or charge you to try and force you to go to the store because it's actually a better route for them. Well, increasingly they don't have that luxury, so it's a very dynamic environment, and in the same way that COVID has had an impact on work from home and life balance and work-life strategies, it's definitely had an impact on retail. The other thing is we are still living in the COVID era right now. It's another thing we forget. Like, all I will say is where I live, when shops opened up, all the private public places that had been busy because people couldn't go to shops and also went out for a walk at the weekend, the volume in those places halved because people wanted to go back to a retail experience. People want to go and shop. So I think we have to be careful of absolutes in this space because I think it will just evolve and find its equilibrium.
Yeah, and I think sort of to your points earlier in terms of the experiential side of it, one thing that really interested me, which will be hilarious to anyone who's ever seen a photograph of me, is that Amazon are trialing hair salons. They're trialing these beautification products, and it's just so interesting to see it kind of go full circle in terms of they're trying, obviously, the DTC model, but in a retail environment, and same with what they're doing with Amazon Fresh, and it'll be interesting to see whether they kind of carry on doing a you know, a sort of first party route where they fully run their own Amazon Fresh stores, or whether they'll end up, you know, acquiring Morrisons, who they've partnered with and have already had a bid. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well.
Yes, I walk past the Amazon salon quite a lot and think, oh, would I use it? And I'm tempted, but I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready for an Amazon salon. I'm just not. I might go to Canary Wharf and use the Amazon Ghost store, give that a go. But the Amazon salon, I feel like it's going to take a bit of courage for me to do that.
The only absolute certainty on this call is the only person who's concerned about the salon will be you, Lindsay.
Is me. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
that ship sailed a while ago for us.
And on that positive note, it's probably a good time to move into the second part of this week's podcast, where we hear all about Simon, about Verizon Media's approach to the post-cookie environment in terms of identity and consolidation. And yeah, Simon, really interested to hear everything that's going on.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. In fact, we did a piece that was on ExchangeWire not long ago talking about some of our solutions. So it's, look, what's going on with Verizon Media? Really interesting time. Obviously, we're in transition. Right now, there's been an offer made by Apollo Capital, so that's working through. Really excited about what that means. We'll likely come out of that branded as Yahoo as a company, and there's lots of opportunities. I think it's great investment in the progress we've made as a business and we've made as a set of programmatic platforms. For us, on our platform side, you know, on the supply side, really just finalizing the last few consolidations to be done. That's been a difficult and challenging journey, but one we're really pleased to come out, and we're seeing rapid increase in feature development. Our DSP has been going from strength to strength, both in the US and internationally, and we're seeing real good growth in the customer base and the effectiveness there. So we have a range of identity solutions, and there's also a number of areas where we'll partner, and it does vary slightly for each area of our business, being both a publisher, being a DSP and an SSP, and each has subtly different approaches. But fundamentally, we have one approach globally, which is Connect ID. That's an authenticated email solution, gathering consent for the consumer, matching that data with advertisers, and being able to match publisher data in. It's a one-to-one solution, so it's our DSP. It's not trying to solve that identity solution for the industry. But it has great interoperability also with other CDPs that are out there, just for managing the onboarding process to the data into our DSP. Then we have a whole range of where we spend a little bit more time on next-gen contextual solutions. They are where we use our seed audience, we use our understanding of our own audience as a publisher, and able to build out models and able to assess what potential audience somebody is in as they're hitting our page or a publisher page, and we can enrich those with other real-time signals. And we can enrich them with data from a publisher, again, relying on consent. So we talked about it earlier about how consent has to be at the core of everything you do. Absolutely, it's at the core of what we're doing. Our approach to cookieless is going to be it's going to be part of many solutions. There isn't one ring to rule them all. We think authenticated solutions, logged in, first party logged in data plays a very significant part. I think that part will probably get very competitive as well, just because of the retraction of size of data. We think different ways of buying with both next-gen audiences and contextual solutions will play a part. And we even see in the long term also some changes to how measurement and success valuation occurs, and we may see more move to things like panels. So like everyone else, we're riding the wave, really pleased with where we are and really pleased with the progress we've seen as a business. And I think, you know, my role is everywhere outside the US. So we're also continuing to just roll through the challenges of COVID and it coming up and down in different regions, some really challenging times in places like India and every market. But I think we've been a robust business, demonstrating really several quarters of really strong performance. So we're really excited about where we are. And we look forward to the future. And I think you'll continue to see some bold and brave moves from us as we head forward. But I do think the identity and targeting piece is something that is going to take 2 to 3 years to really resolve for the whole industry. My only suggestion to anyone listening is to be experimenting with everything, to trial everything, to understand what works for you. If you're a publisher, if you're a buyer, understand how you may need to think and change your strategies. But I don't think there's a magic cure, and I don't think there's the one ring solution. So we think we've got a great breadth of solutions that can help in a cookieless environment, but we also think we're going to have to see how the industry develops. And when we talked about Flocker, there are other proposals for Privacy Sandbox, and some of those are really quite interesting, but they don't even start testing till later on in this year. So we have to understand how those impact the shape of how digital advertising works moving forward as well. Crazy times, man. This used to be a really easy job. Exactly. I should have been a computer scientist, apparently, or a lawyer. That's where these two things intersect.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Blend of all of them. One question I wanted to ask in terms of, obviously, your role sits across multiple markets. Is there kind of a broad understanding and kind of recognition that it's going to be a kind of patchwork of solutions going forward, or is it still a mentality in some markets in particular that it's very much, oh, we need to try and find a cookie replacement to keep doing what we're doing?
It's inconsistent. I don't know that the difference is market. I think it's just inconsistent everywhere.
Okay.
So I think certainly I would say there has been more conversation around it in some of the larger, more developed markets. I think there are some of the smaller markets, there's maybe less awareness. The other thing that makes a big change is the impact of privacy regulation actually changes which solutions and how and where people are looking. So, and that is an increasingly complex piece. Like, it, you know, I like to think of my business in simplistic terms as EMEA and APAC and LATAM, right? And those are the bits I'm influencing over and have great teams in all those. Well, LATAM is not one country, right? It has six different bits of legislation we're working through right now. EMEA, there are two now, three really, right? Because there's obviously GDPR, but there's also what will the UK path be forward? An APAC, differing rules coming out in Australia versus Thailand or Taiwan. So really complex. These things create barriers to business. I think the awareness is greater in the US and EMEA than it is potentially in APAC, although I think that curve is, and again, Australia probably is more aligned to the US and UK in that conversation. There's a little bit of English language speaking there. No, I don't think it's consistent. No, and I don't think it will be super smooth as well. I think it's going to be bumpy for a few people. That's why, you know, the one thing we encourage is just open dialogue around it. And there's a challenge for salespeople always try and sell you a solution. I think it's incumbent on sellers to sell the solutions they have, but also be transparent that this is not, there is, I think we said this in the piece actually, Matt. I was about to say something, then I was like, I'm certain I've said this to you already. Cookies in some ways were great because they did so many things, but they were also doing so many things they weren't intended to do. And so the trouble is, the challenge is that we're now not allowing cookies to do those things. We now have to find ways to do the things that we can't do anymore. But they can't always be one solution, because otherwise you're just back to a cookie by another name. And we come back to the privacy arc, and the privacy arc is not cross-site tracking with that level of addressability in the same way. So long answer, sorry. It's difficult to be succinct on this topic. I think we will also see the knowledge is definitely ramping up this year versus last year. So that acceleration is happening. I think it will also happen more in the second half of this year as we get closer to the potential Chrome deadline, but also as these trials start to output more results, and therefore there's more discussion about what people can do or how they need to adapt their strategy. You've run away now as well, Lindsay.
Spoiled my day.
Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us as well, even though now you're going to be naturally disappointed for the rest of the day.
Yes.
And thank you all ever so much for listening. That's this week's Mad Tech Podcast.